Hi everyone, this is Chris DC, and it was such a treat this week to catch up with Anna Neal. Now, Anna works in the music industry. She has sat on various committees, including the Ivor Novello's. She has worked in the music industry professionally for 20 years. Now, she talks about how academia is a form of performance. Anna works at the University of Kent, and she talks about how it is possible for an industry professional to step into the academic arena. And her research focuses on songwriting in industry practice. She talks about always having been business savvy and the implications of technology on songwriting and how we live today in an attention economy. It's time, not money, that's precious. We talk about the disassociation now between the artist and the fan. There's no loyalty to a track on Spotify in the way that there once was with vinyl. We talk about how students today will listen to music that she heard when she was their age. That's not something that happened in previous generations. We talk about the difference between analogue and digital sound, how radio was the be-all and end-all when she was growing up, and now Spotify has taken its place. But we talk about the extent to which radio might still be relevant. She questions why the charts are still there in their present format. She talks about how she studied music at Oxford Brookes. She was a member of the band The Commitments. She talks about a project that she did 10 years ago with Mary Beard. She talks about how her memories are predominantly positive. And we learn that when you're not a creative practitioner, it's a little dangerous to go too far down the nostalgia path. And at the very end of the interview, Anna talks about why art can be a good way of keeping nostalgia in check. So it was absolutely brilliant to catch up with Anna Neal from the University of Kent for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is such a pleasure to have Anna Neal, who surprised me, I have to be honest, Anna, because we only met once before a few weeks ago. And of course, we both work at the University of Kent. And my jaw dropped when I met you, because of course, you do the very things that people like me can only dream of, which is not to study music, but you actually do it, you imbibe it, you live it out. And so this is going to be, I think, a dream interview.
Oh, I try. I'll be on my best behaviour.
All right. Well, the same goes here. But Anna, so how long have you been working at Kent?
I've been at Kent. This is my fourth year at the University of Kent.
But we know you for other reasons, because I've seen your, obviously you have a website and you do lots of music videos and you do jingles. And you, is it the Ivor Novello Awards as well that you work with?
Yeah, so I'm on various committees within the music industry. So I'm on the Ivors Academy, which run the Ivor Novello Awards. I'm on the Songwriter Committee and the Equality, Diversity, Inclusion Steer Group. I've been on award committees for them as well, Musicians Union. But I've been working professionally in music for 20 years. It's my 20th year this year. So quite a long time, but in a variety of different roles.
And if you had to do what I hate doing, which is to try, you know, we all wear different hats in different contexts. Like some people know me because I put film reviews up on Facebook, or people know me as somebody who, you know, is a teacher who does courses on religion and the modern world at the University of Kent, that sort of thing. But we all have, you know, if I had to sort of sum myself up, there probably are things that go back decades, well before I'd even knew what academia was, that kind of summed me up. In your case, do you kind of feel that the having those different persona, if that's what it is, I don't know how separate or separable they are of being an academic and being a musician. How would you categorize yourself?
Oh, that's a tough one. So when people ask me who I am and what I do, I always say that I'm an artist, because I started out as an artist, and an artist encompasses all sorts of things. You know, the singer-songwriter, which is how I started out, the composer, the performer, you know, the campaigner, if you like, the storyteller, reimagining things like that. How does it relate to, I mean, you know, academia is another form of performing, really. So it's kind of a natural progression from being on stage for 20 years to carrying those skills over into a lecture theatre or a workshop or something like that. And I like having a diverse range of roles. I get quite bored quite quickly. I think that's the kind of thing with the creative mind, is you're constantly on the go. So it's good to be able to write some songs, but then it's nice to be able to write them for other people and tell their stories. And it's nice to be able to go and help the next generation. And it's nice to be able to go and do something else, you know, like the podcast, or just do a different variety of things. Just I think it keeps you young, if I'm honest. I think it does.
Yeah, I think the performance bit is really interesting, because I'm aware sometimes, and of course the students wouldn't know it because they're of a different generation, but I'm very aware that I'm doing kind of two things. First of all, I'm content-wise, I'm doing the sort of things that my lecturers were doing 30 years ago. But on the other hand, I'm very aware that in that context of performance, that there are people who I listen to on the radio, there are people I grew up with who are kind of the role models in a different way. And I think you're right. When you're lecturing, sometimes there's that side which comes out where you kind of think, if this was a radio show, you know, the only thing missing are the jingles, the travel news, and the vinyl. And then suddenly you've got the full package. And it's interesting to sort of be aware that you're doing that, but the students are not there for that. I think the performance is important in terms of what you're doing, but it's interesting that what underscores that performance is something that may have nothing to do with academia at all. Sounds like you've got a similar kind of heritage.
Yeah, I mean, my lectures, I try and base them on my personal and professional experience, on information I get from working in the music industry and from academic resources at all. So I like to think that my content's kind of a delivery between the three. And that's how I view academia. I don't view it as being, you know, you're in this one area and therefore you focus just on that. I know it can be quite problematic in methodology and all sorts of other areas where you go, well, okay, it's not written down in a book and therefore it doesn't count. So I try to follow on from heritage in songwriting in particular, you know, look at Bob Dylan, look at Joni Mitchell, look at Kate Bush, look at how they wrote the songs. How does that compare to now? So I like to kind of keep a mix in it, but I don't come from a traditional academic background. You know, I am very much an industry professional that stepped into this arena, and sometimes I sort of stand there looking around going, okay, this is very, I get surprised, I think, at how, I don't want to say the word precious, but it does feel like people are quite precious about things being definite and exact. And it's like, well, this is a creative art. Nothing is definite and exact. It's not possible.
But I think it's that notion of hinterland, though, and also maybe counterpoint is a good word, because when I started doing this podcast in 2018, my sense was that people were going to say, oh yeah, you know, my father went to university and his father went to university, and so I was destined to do this and I was going to be a professor, etc. That is not what has come out. For many people, it's sort of luck, happenstance, maybe first generation, as I was. No one in my family, well, my sister, who's a few years older than me, had been to university. And so we found ourselves doing things that there was no template for within our families. And yet the really interesting thing is that so many of the people I've interviewed will talk about the gigs they went to in the, you know, in the 70s or 80s. They will talk with more passion about the sporting things or the first record they bought or the films they went to see. And that has kind of molded who they are. And I said to one of the people I interviewed who until recently worked at Kent, I said, you know, if you had to choose, you know, if you had to define yourself in a certain way and you had to choose, you know, the sporting stuff you do or the academia, which is how I know you, which would you choose? And he said, it's a no-brainer. He'd rather do his windsurfing. And that is something where he's in touch with nature, and he's able to express things that the academia, in a way, is an important, you know, is what brings the money in, but it's not the sort of the way that you sort of want to have on your epitaph. And I found that an interesting change of fortune. So how did you end up then in academia, when your background, and no doubt many of the people you work with, probably don't have that same kind of, you know, forging of connections?
I mean, you'd be surprised at how many people in the music industry now work in academia. I mean, you know, there are some that do it for the money. Then there are some because they see it as a natural progression. You know, there isn't a lot of difference between putting an album together and putting together a research paper, really. You're still doing the same process. So a lot of the processes and applications are the same. They're just a slightly different way of presenting things, if you like. And it kind of saddens me that some people are like, oh, well, like, you know, my interest is outside of my field, because I suppose with music, I count myself as being really lucky that I get to work in music, but it's a vocation, you know. It's not just something I do, it is part of my identity and personality. And so I suppose that The academic side is just another part of that, and investigating and contributing to the heritage of that, you know. Yeah, whoever does windsurfing, do a paper on windsurfing. That sounds amazing.
but that's the thing, isn't it? Because the stuff I do on nostalgia, it started out as a very traditional academic project, as in, what do film studies people say about nostalgia? What do anthropologists say, sociologists, theologians, etc.? And then what I was finding is that, and I suppose it's this whole turn to the self kind of trajectory where people were saying, you know, let me tell you my story. And I realized I had my own story, but because I didn't feel there was an obvious place for that in the research that I had traditionally done, which is always, you know, let's bring together lots of academic voices and let's sort of, you know, develop all these paradigms and do those very important things where you're, perhaps when you're doing a PhD, you're trying to prove something. But then I thought, the things that are really interesting me and the things that people were really letting their guard down with was the personal narrative. Mm-hmm. And then I've started to find a way of commingling those two realms. But but the podcast started off as an addendum to all of that. It was very much, you know, it's like we, just before we started recording, the sort of the day job and the night job kind of thing. But it's like the academic by day, but by night, I put together a podcast. And then I realized that actually the realms are not separable, that the two actually can work well, not least if you're interviewing academics. And of course, that becomes your daytime vocation as well. But how does it work for you? Because you've got a podcast, which I get the sense actually more than one, but there's one that I just heard the first episode of this week. And I know that you interviewed the drummer from Blur, but do you want to say a bit about your podcast and how that fits in with what you research and study?
Yeah, I mean, my research focuses on songwriting and industry practice and technology as well. So I'm partway through my PhD on that. And it's not a practice as arts research. It's written form, but I've noticed, you know, from my experience of being an artist and being an independent artist, you know, I kind of shunned the traditional structures of the music industry because I looked at it and went, well, you don't know what you're doing. You're not doing anything for me. So I learned the business side, and I've always been very business savvy. And being business savvy, I realized that what you would get is a whole barrage of podcasts that would say, you know, work in the music industry, it's wonderful. And oh, I'm so lucky and I'm blessed and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. It's not that. It's not glamorous. It's hard. And there are lots of issues, especially at the moment. You know, we have all sorts of things with streaming rates, abuse of copyright, stuff like that, that isn't being covered. And I thought, you know, if I was an artist now, I would want, you know, starting out, I would want to know exactly what I was getting into, because committing to this now is very different to how it was 20 years ago when I started. Committing to this now means that you are probably going to end up having a job outside of the industry. You're going to earn very little money. Whatever you record may not be successful. You know, it's, the percentages and the chances are really, really small. So I said to a friend of mine, right, we need to cover this and we need to talk about it and say what it's really like, but in a positive way, you know, to say, look, this is how it is. This is how it's impacting creators. However, this could be an art, so, you know, what is the point? So that's why what's the point came up. You know, what's the point of being an artist? What's the point of music industry? And Dave is a friend of mine, luckily. So I've worked with Dave, and I know him through associations at the Ivors, and he's head of the Featured Artist Coalition. And I met him at a music conference about 15 years ago, where Napster was like at the height of destroying the music industry. And I remember the head of EMI standing up and going, we're not worried about Napster. It's not a problem. Nope. It's not gonna raise our royalties at a time when it already was. And Dave stood up and called him something along the lines of an idiot. So he's very tech savvy, and he had all this, what he says in the podcast is he had all this evidence to show that how the music industry was treating arts, you know, music, was going to destroy it. And lo and behold, we're dealing with the repercussions of that. So that ties into my research. You know, what are the implications of technology on me as a songwriter, on my peers as a songwriter? You know, what's going to happen to song as we understand it? Is it changing completely? People don't listen anymore. You know, they don't. And we see that with film at the moment. You know, you're talking about film. Well, people are watching films. They can flick through them on Netflix. What's going to happen to cinema? So there are repercussions for this. It started with music. It's now starting to affect film. It's affecting books as well. You know, with Amazon, it was monopoly, tech monopolies on books. There's a whole chain reaction to this. It will get to TV at some point, but TV is the last standing stone, if you like. So there are implications for this for our cultural industries on top of other issues, you know, political issues.
Because I always found, I mean, my parents, when I was, you know, 7 or 8 and I was early 80s listening to the Human League or Toya or Bucks Fizz or whatever, you know, all Shakin' Stevens, who lived next door, or his parents lived next door to my piano teacher. And what was funny is that growing up then, my parents were always like, oh, it's not as good as it was when we were growing up. And I was like, oh,
yeah,
come on, it's, the, you know, because I had nothing to compare it with. But the funny thing is I've got kids now who are, you know, the eldest is 9, but the interest that I have in music today is nothing compared to what 30, 12, I'm in my late 40s now, so 80s particularly I was really into, to the point that, and I don't know whether it that the music scene has changed or I have changed or probably a bit of both, but it's the same with film. Until lockdown, I'd be going to the cinema as a primary means of going to see films because that made it seem like an event. Buying a record from Woolworths HMV felt like an event. Having it in your hand, I'd hear it on the radio, like it, go and buy it. Somehow streaming, pressing a button, if you don't like it, move on to the next thing, takes away that rite of passage. So I don't know, is that something, is that an experience that other people tend to have, or is it just simply a generational difference?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think it would be very easy for me as a professional to turn around and say it's all the fault of Spotify. End of. It's not. There are, you know, records in the 50s and 60s were 2 minutes long and dictated to by the format of vinyl. You know, there's a whole catalogue of things that happen within music, certainly, that influence the shape and choices. I mean, the only reason we have the Kate Bushes and the Peter Gabriels and the Genesis is because there suddenly you could put more music onto a piece of plastic. You know, that's as unromantic as that sounds, that is the truth. But there is some evidence to suggest that, you know, there's something called attention economy. And there is some evidence to say that we are living in an attention economy now where time is the thing that is measurable and precious, not money. And therefore you are bombarding people with content because the focus is on content. People can only spend a certain amount of time on content and you're competing against other platforms for content. Now I was a teenager in the 90s. So to me, music was everything. You know, the band that you supported, if it's Oasis or Blur, meant everything. That doesn't matter to my children. And that's not because they don't like music. It's because they don't know who they're listening to, because you go, hey, Alexa, play this. So there's a disassociation between an artist now and the fan. But people are still wanting music, but they want the music to create to mood or sync to activities and things like that. And it's just a shift and a change. And I don't think anyone, which is partly why I'm doing my PhD research, has really ascertained what the ramifications are for this change, because everything is so fast now. And that's not a generational thing. That's actually true, that things are so fast now, that there's going to come a point where we're going to hit a wall. And it's interesting to see the kind of resurgence of vinyl sales, where people are going back to buying vinyl to listen to, because listening to vinyl is a commitment. You listen to one side, you have to get up, you have to turn it over, and you have to listen to the other side. Even listening to a CD was a certain level of commitment. Now listening to a track on Spotify, there's no loyalty there at all. So there are all sorts of, you know, what's the industry's part in this? You know, what has the business side done to this to create, because the business side has created this situation. That's what's happened. So there's a cultural implications. There's all sorts of levels of complexity. But yeah, I try not to do that. Can you turn that down, please? Because it's too loud, because I'm too old.
I used to have this record player and it was always like, don't put it above number 3 because it'll wake the neighbours. And it was like, so maybe we get away 3.5. It's like something out of Spinal Tap. But the thing that is interesting is I remember The Jam, Town Called Malice and Precious, because the industry released as a double A-side. And of course, there are many other examples of that. So, of course, to keep the record going. And it was interesting to see in the Christmas charts, Wham! With Last Christmas, making its number 1 after 38 years or 37 years or something like that. And then that being number 1 through listens, I'm guessing on Spotify or, you know, through streaming. But of course, I remember, you know, 84, Band-Aid, it didn't get to number 1 because of that. And it was a vinyl thing that you bought, you had it in your hand. And it's interesting that vinyl has come back, but I wonder in the same way whether, because I used to record loads of stuff from the radio, legally or otherwise, 30 years ago, I still listen to those original recordings. I still got the stuff. It's not very professional, but it's more that there's a moment in time, there's a sense that this was manufactured at a time and place, and you can prove that by having, I may have transferred it onto CD or you listen to it in the car, but there's an original version of it somewhere which is on a cassette tape. And it's the same with vinyl. And I wonder if that's the thing, that for music to really work, it has to be grounded in something, it has to be contextualized, it has to be autobiographical. And I wonder whether that might be the thing that shifted, because pressing a button and you can listen to the same thing on multiple devices, it takes maybe the magic away from it, because you don't have to travel far and wide to get something. It's there at the click of a mouse. And I kind of don't like it when things are that easy.
We have access to everything now, instantly. There's no, you know, when I bought a CD in 1997, I saved up my pocket money, and I remember walking to town to go to Virgin Megastore, because I'm from Woking. So I went to the same school as Paul Weller, albeit many, many years apart, and buying like Oasis's third album. I remember queuing up for it, you know, because you felt part of a culture and identity. You know, I did confess this to Dave, by the way. He does know I was an Oasis fan, but he does know what my reasons were behind it. So I've been officially forgiven for this one. But I remember buying that and I felt like part of a tribe and a culture and a community, because I was part of this Oasis fan base that was going to listen to this album first. And I could talk to my friends about that. And I've still got that CD. And I don't listen to it, but I keep it because it's a sentimental attachment. And I, you know, you're saying about an autobiographical thing. They say that it's the music between the ages of, I think, 13 to 25 that stay with you for the rest of your life. So once you reach the 25 point, anything else you listen to that is not going to have as much meaning and not going to be one of your favourite albums, no matter how much of a connoisseur you are musically. So there's that element to it. And also, I think that there are arguments that it's the quality question again, isn't it? You know, there are always album fillers on albums. Don't be under the impression that the industry actually fought really hard about those 12 tracks on that CD, because they didn't. They put album fillers. But sometimes those album fillers, you know, whatever song is written has an autobiographical account from the writer, whether that be the singer, you know, the artist or the team that put the track together. They're representing something for the artist, like Britney Spears' album. I wonder if we've lost that. I wonder now, with the focus on singles, it's just a sweet spot, a hit point of a 1 3-minute song now with no other further story. And fans need something to connect with. And I don't think music fans now have anything in the mainstream to connect with.
Yeah, I find that growing up, there was always that sense of loyalty and commitment. Actually reading Pete Pafaidis' recent book about growing up in Birmingham to a Greek immigrant family. And he actually went to the same university as me. And it's fascinating to see this whole sense that you listen to, I don't know, Teardrop Explodes, or you listen to an artist and you want the next record. And if you look at the charts in, you know, 81, 82, it's the same artists who sort of, and then they it goes on for a few years. And then there's a point where maybe, you know, the next generation of artists comes along. You know, I think of like the whole Nick Kershaw, Howard Jones thing. It was very, that's like, so 84, 85. By the time you get to 86, that had all kind of blown away. But if you grew up as I did in that era, that music feels as real and as fresh now. Paul Simon, apparently, I don't know where I read this, but apparently when he's driving through America, he always listens to a radio station that plays music circa 19, I think it was 57. And I looked it up, and of course he was exactly within that demographic that you're talking about. Let's say he was, I don't know, 16 or 17 at the time. And for him, that's his driving music. And it's music that, of course, he grew up with. Whereas for me, anything, I was listening to Pick of the Pops last week, and it was 1981 or early 82. I knew what was going to be number one. I could almost like work out almost within a week, you know, what was going to be there. But that all went by the end of the decade. And I find it interesting that I've got this almost this very set kind of set of interests. And I wonder whether music is simply quality proof if you're from that generation. It doesn't matter if you grew up with Britney Spears, it's irrelevant what if anybody thinks it's kitsch. It doesn't matter if anybody thinks that it's, you know, it's not good quality, because if you grew up with it and you feel very precious about that. And I wonder if you can ever change that kind of mindset.
I think if you work in music, I would listen to an album by the Cranberries and have some kind of association because it was the first album that I bought. But I can assess it professionally as a musician and recognise stylistic things that dictate it's the 90s genre specific things. I can recognise that maybe it's not the most amazing piece of music ever, and I could go back and I could listen to Peter Gabriel's Four or so. I mean, you know, okay, I was little when that came out, but I can listen to that and go, okay, this musically is like amazing. I mean, it is just the musicianship is top notch, the writing is top notch, you know, the thought in production is top notch. And I can go back to something that Supertramp wrote in the 70s and I can apply the same thing to that. I understand the process of how they're writing in the studio now because I'm sort of part of that process. You know, I'm not in every other writing session, I'm not part of the mainstream in a traditional sense. But I can't assess it in the same way that I could compare it to Graceland or So or Hounds of Love or any of those albums. There is no way you can compare it because the way that that is, things are produced now is not the same as it was then. So has real musicians on it. It was arranged. It was thought out. It was put together by musicians, by the writer. It was crafted by a producer. What you hear now can be a teenager in their bedroom who's incredibly talented, but they're doing everything on their own, on their laptop, in Logic, mastering it themselves and putting it out themselves, using the same sound libraries as everyone else is using, using the same techniques. Now, there is always going to be recycling in music. There was in the 90s, there was in the 80s. It's prevalent. Whatever's successful will be copied. Now it's much easier to copy. You know, now you could argue that technology allows a space to be creative, but actually is it cornering us into a box because we have to do things quickly. We have to produce content all the time. It has to sound a certain way to be acceptable. No one's going to... I listened to Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill the other week. And on Mary Jane, she hits a really bum note. And her voice cracks. And I've always heard it. And you just accept it for the aesthetic, for the part of the record. And my kids were like, oh, that's awful. You know, and I was like, no one would accept that now. You could not get away with that. But then you have to question, what artistic relevance does that bum note have? You know, it augmented the fact that that was a live album, and it was. It was one of the best recorded live albums ever. You wouldn't get that now.
Well, a friend of mine who recently left Kent was in the classics department. She's gone back to America, and she was at Live Aid, but the Philadelphia Stadium event, and she was talking about Duran Duran, and she sent me the link, and I'd forgotten it. But when Simon Le Bon, when he's singing View to a Kill, he misses the note. I mean, he squeaks out, you know, one of the lines, and of course everyone laughs at it. But actually, it's like, I think Phil Collins on the same day with the drums. I think it was he missed the note or some other, and of course everyone remembers that from the day, but also it was a live event. It was the thing that we remember, and actually that kind is like with vinyl, isn't it? Because it crackles.
Yeah,
there's something quote authentic about it in a way that you wouldn't get when, you know, when it sounds really pristine. Sometimes it just feels like it's done in an airless studio. You kind of want to feel that it was done around people, with people, that maybe it was a bit raw, maybe they got it a bit wrong, because that perhaps is a bit of a truer reflection of ourselves as listeners to that. You know, our lives don't, you know, always work in a vacuum. We have, there's always a bit of texture and a bit of hiss and a bit of crackle. Mm-hmm. And I think the music accompanies that. And I think for me, when CDs and then, you know, we lost vinyl, and then CDs were in them, you know, were themselves then taken over and, you know, transformed or, you know, mutated into streaming. Somehow I just felt that I wanted to stay where I was, or maybe even look backwards. And it's interesting to follow, within the matter of just a few decades, that kind of trajectory.
Yeah, and also what I find really interesting is students now listen to the music that I listened to when I was their age. I would not have a million years listened to the music my parents listened to. Nope. And sometimes I'll say Alanis Morissette, like, who? But, you know, about 60% of the time, I'll say, they're like, yeah, it's a really good album. And I sit there and say, okay, so you're actually listening to this because you want to, not because I'm saying you have to. Well, okay, I didn't want to listen to what my lecturer told me to listen to 20 years ago. I don't want to listen to stuff my parents listen to. It's not cool. So there's that element. I mean, in terms of vinyl, analog and digital recording are two completely separate things. If you record something analog, it will have a warmer, sorry, maybe rawer as well, sound to it than a digital thing will. you know, I'm recording my voice now digitally in a series of zeros and ones. It's not going to sound the same and as rich if I recorded it to tape, to reel to reel. And there are bands like Royal Blood that are specifying they want to go into the studios that have got reel to reel and they want to do it old school. And that's why, you know, I bought Amy Winehouse's Back to Black on vinyl because I wanted it for an aesthetic reason. Even though I had it on CD, I listened to the vinyl, doesn't work because the mastering was designed for CD at the time. If I buy Kate Bush's Hounds of Love on vinyl, that is spot on because it was designed, mastered, produced for an analog format, recorded in an analog format. There are all considerations. You know, if you want to listen to music properly, listen to the format it was recorded in, because then you'll get to hear it at its best.
How big was, say, radio, though, growing up? Because for me, that was the primary means of getting music growing up. Now, of course, it isn't. I mean, my children, I think, find it very, you know, faintly odd that I would listen to the radio. Who's that? What, listen to that voice, you know, sort of, you know, they just want to hear the music, end of. For me, it's all the bit in between. It's the contextualization. But was that an important part? Work with radio professionals and you're in that industry, but to what extent does radio continue to have an important role?
I mean, radio when I grew up was the be all and end all. You listen to the Capital charts and it was Dr. Fox, and you'd go to the Capital ball and you'd try and get his autograph, and you'd I was that part of the demographic that taped off the radio, you know, because that's what you did, and you'd pray that the DJ would not talk over the beginning or the end. Now Spotify has taken the place of radio in terms of providing playlists. Radio is still relevant, but there's been a real desecration of local radio. So local radio services have disappeared. The national groups such as Bayer and Global have reduced their playlist capacity to literally just focus on the very most popular tracks to keep their audience listening. So for an artist now, unless you go to BBC Six, so BBC introducing, or you go to the local radio stations that do introducing, it is impossible to get on those radio stations now. I don't know what the future of radio is. Radio advertising is doing very well. You know, there's still a lot of money in radio advertising as there is in TV advertising. People in lockdown, the listenership went up for radio, particularly for the national BBC stations. But I think it may be that it becomes less personalised. And the thing is, when I was growing up listening to radio, you had such a choice of different radio stations. You could choose the genre you'd listen to, a bit like being in America. You know, America had like 600 radio stations. I think the choice will become less, which again plays into the whole oversaturation, very limited attention spans, only a few tracks get through. All of it ties in together. You know, without radio, without a DJ promoting an artist, it's really hard for an artist to establish some kind of significance.
I mean, growing up, the thing that we always did, it was always on a Monday morning after the charts on a Sunday. We'd all listen to and of course, in a funny way, it's almost like a mirror of what's happening in lockdown when we all listen in our own private spaces. And then we sort of share experiences, but we're not physically in the same environment. But Monday morning, we'd always be talking about what had gone up, what had gone down, our favourite records. You know, if my favourite record was number one and somebody else's record was out of the top 10, there was almost that kind of, you know, sense of, hey, well, my choice, my tastes are better than yours. But is that something that is still there? I mean, I know the charts are now, the fact they're on a Friday now is interesting because it's sort of taken away that tradition that people like me grew up with. And it was almost sort of, you know, it was that ritual, 5 o'clock listening. And of course, we teletext aside, if you
remember that
was it. You missed it. Now, of course, you miss it. Just listen to it whenever you like. So is that part of it? Is it something about the fact that even with, you know, whether it's live radio or pre-recorded, you can get it on demand, and the event has been taken out of radio's excitement?
I think it's part of it, and I think it's partly also a revolt from the public. You know, the public has been fed for years tastemakers' choices, gatekeepers' choices. You know, if you may not choose to listen to Kate Bush, but you were going to listen to Kate Bush whether you liked it or not. Now, you could argue that those artists are phenomenal artists and therefore we were lucky to have them, and that was part of the system of development in the music industry. There is no development in the music industry now. The development is not done by labels anymore. The charts are just... I've spoken to people who run the charts companies. I have to be very careful what I say here. And I know how they put these charts together. I knew how they put them together in the 90s. I mean, in the 90s, it wasn't, you know, oh, so-and-so got to number one, big deal. It was, who did you follow? it wasn't so much a focus on the charts. We just used the charts to tape the music, to be honest. Now the charts, I don't know why they're there. I'll be honest, I don't know why we don't have the diversification that they do in the United States. I don't know why we have one mainstream chart. It feels like a dying breed that the industry is trying to flog, a bit like certain award ceremonies I won't mention, to try and, you know, promote their own artists. That's what it's there for. And I think people have got fed up with it. And the trouble is, if you feed people rubbish, they will ignore it and they will find their own thing. And there is, you know, the one bit of hope is there is a massive growth in the independent sector. You know, people will go and find folk music and follow folk music as a genre, or they'll go and find, you know, grime or trap or EDM or something like that. So it's allowed space for that, but it's just there are so many voices within that.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of then the transition to university, because is this what you were studying as an undergraduate, or were you doing something completely different and then found your way back to, you know, to square the circle, as it were, later on?
I studied music at university, and I studied music because I didn't pick up the guitar till I was 14 and I felt like I was behind. So I went to university to learn. So I was really choosy about where I went, because I wanted to do my main line of interest was pop music, but I also wanted to study elements of classical as well, because I was interested in that and jazz. So where I studied, it's Oxford Brookes is where I did my undergraduate degree, and it was a mix of popular music, classical, bit of jazz, theatre, everything. And I did go there to learn. So I would read the books and listen to the playlists, and not playlists, but the CDs. I would do that because I felt like I was catching up. And I mean, I started writing songs when I was at school, when I'd started picking the guitar up when I was 14. And I ended up, when I was at college, I got into a support band for the Commitments. So I was in their support band for a while, and then I managed to get in the band because their singer didn't turn up one night, and I worked for their management company. So I did a couple of shows actually in the Commitments as a member of the Commitments. It was pretty cool at 18. So I was focusing on being a professional singer because that was where my career was going. So I was trying to manage the first year of my music degree while being involved with this proper music industry touring band. That was quite tough. But it was doing sort of independent study and sort of through mentoring by my lectures, I think, because I was kind of into it. But I rediscovered my love of songwriting. So when I came out of university, the focus was on being a singer-songwriter, you know, and on the craft of song.
Yeah. And when you were at university, what difference did that have on your sense of what music could do? Were you able to sort of channel a lot of your own love of your passion of music into the degree? Or did you find that maybe the fact that you're doing a PhD in this area now, did you kind of then feel afterwards that that was a chance for you to sort of reframe the current state of academic discourse in music? You know, what sort of did you feel that you were able to bring a different sort of approach to the whole discipline that you're studying and still involved with?
There's quite a big gap between my undergraduate degree and starting the PhD. I mean, a 20-year gap. So I mean, the degree made me reassess everything that I thought I knew, and it opened up, certainly in songwriting, it opened up a new way of looking at songwriting that wasn't just purely academic, it was also creative as well. And that was because of the love by my lecturer, the head of the music department, kind of was infectious, if you like, as to, you know, if you feel like there's a purpose and a point to something, you will latch onto that and take that baton and run with it. So I think, you know, I mean, I can still remember my lectures on the Traviata and Verdi and Mozart and things like that. And that has stayed with me. Most of my content from my lectures, I can remember, you know, and it stays with me, and I listen to the music and I understand the story. But I think it was unpicking the stories for me that kind of unlocked the door, and you know, being told that there isn't one right way to think about things. There are multiple ways to think about things. And that's come back into play with the PhD now. You know, a song is not a singular form. It's not a singular understanding. It's a multiple, you know, and you cannot have a black or white answer for this. There's a whole catalogue universe, if you like, a whole new universe of possibilities. And it can be quite infuriating as a creative, because although you're aware that there are multiples within your creative practice. So when you write a song, it's not A to B, it changes. You know, your song you wrote last year will be completely different this year, and you take it in the studio, it's different again, and it's different again when you do it live. But you reach an end point. So when you've done that live version, it's finished. When you've done that studio version, it's finished. If you do a different arrangement, it's finished. In academia, there's no finish point. not in the creative arts. You know, there, it could go on and on and on. I'll do this PhD and I'll have 20 threads that I could explore from this PhD and go on and on and on and on. And it doesn't, and it's trying to align your thinking to think that that's a good thing and not, oh God, I've got another thing to do.
It's funny when that happens, because some people doing a PhD will say, oh, you know, that was maybe more old school, but they'd say, oh, it's a lifelong project. So, you know, you never stop learning. It's never going to be ready to submit, because there's always going to be new work out there. Whereas I always took the approach, well, you have to have a cutoff point, because it's the same with anything. You're never going to be satisfied. And that's always what subsequent research is for. You know, there's always a sense in which you've got, that's your next project, so have a cut off and then, you know, then assess the scene from that point on. But in your case, do you find, as I do sometimes, if I'm teaching my students, I do some stuff on religion and film, and you know, we always sort of talk about how once you've looked at different, I don't know, Jesus films, or you look at anything that perhaps you would in the past have watched, quote, for pleasure, but now you can't not watch something without seeing it through a particular lens, or you've been immersed in something that just makes you think differently. And I wonder, in that sense, just as maybe you're writing obviously on music in your PhD, but I'm guessing that you, in your music, you're also consciously or otherwise going to be writing about things, whether you're doing it sort of overtly or otherwise, about what you're about, the whole the other side, the counterpoint to that, about your PhD. Is there a sense in which that one feeds off the other, that you can express yourself, maybe, you know, even literally in some cases, on the same day as you're working on these two different paradigms in juxtaposition?
I mean, yeah, my PhD comes from my professional experience. So I come from this, in, you know, I'm always being told that my position could create a whole new form of methodology. I don't know what that is yet, but I'm told this all the time. That's infuriating in itself. But, you know, I work in this environment and I've seen the change, and I have had to change the way I write songs for me, for other artists. And I'm doing that all the time. And then that feeds back into the theory, and you go, well, I found the backup for this, and I found other people are doing this, and I speak to my colleagues and I interview them, and all of it feeds together. And then all of a sudden you find that, because you've read it theoretically there and you're writing about it theoretically, well, I better apply it to my practice. But I'm already applying it to my practice anyway. But now I'm consciously applying it to my practice and aware. So the two, it works in like one big circle, if you like. The two feed into each other. But yeah, trying to express, I'm trying to veer off doing the creating an album as part of my PhD. There will be songs in the appendix, because that's how I can professionally showcase how this works. But I'm trying to veer off the whole, here's an album and a little bit of written stuff. I want this to be, no, okay, this is happening, and why is this happening, and linking it back. And I'm trying to use my storytelling expertise in an academic sense, but without the storytelling language, if that makes sense.
I mean, what about the teachers then who taught you at university? Are you in touch with them? Do they know what you're doing? Yeah. Do they kind of, I'm guessing that they must be like, wow, you know, because you've clearly stayed in that same, you've done the degree in music, but you're very much both academically and in terms of practice, you're very much working in that area. But do you kind of feel that you've changed their paradigm, if you like?
I don't know whether I've changed their paradigm. I go back and do lectures for them sometimes, and I do their careers days. They've got a few more kind of more recent successful graduates. So obviously, you know, I graduated in 2003, so I'm officially ancient now. And I maybe not quite as down with the kids, but I don't think it's changed. I mean, the staffing has changed, so therefore the disciplines have changed. I'm still in contact with two members of staff who were there, so both of whom were there when I was there, but the head of the department is now retired, but I'm still in contact with him. And we'll talk about songwriting, and I saw him a couple of years ago. I hadn't seen him for a long, long time. So I don't think any student would change the structure or the paradigm of the study or the university because you've got those experts in there. I think you can contribute as a alumni, you can contribute and say, this is what I got out of the course, which is great, you know, and students that come back to Kent will say, I got this out of your lesson. And, you know, if I have a songwriting student that comes back to me and says, that was really inspired, it doesn't happen very often. I'm not trying to not take that personally. You know, I've been really inspired by this and now I'm going to do singers, you know, now I'm going to pursue this. That's amazing. You know, to think that you have, you know, it's one thing people listening to your song and saying, oh, I listened to it at my wedding and it was, you know, you sort of embarrassingly go, oh, thank you, you know, thank you. That, and, you know, inside you're going, yes. But for a student to turn around and say to you that you have inspired them, it's kind of completing the circle, if you like. Somebody inspired me to get into this and achieve this. And without this, I wouldn't be who I am now. If I can do that to somebody else, then that's a massive tick, really, isn't it? That's a kind of a life achievement thing, I think.
Yeah, and it's priceless, because in the same way I want to go back, and sometimes I do go back to my alma mater, and I'll talk to them about this. And it's funny because the film thing, which my PhD was looking at religion and film, but I did a degree in theology, and it's so funny that so much of what I'm teaching the students is the same as what I was doing all those years ago. But the fact is, I'm looking at it through the lens of film, which was like the one bit that was missing all those years ago. But I'm kind of glad in a way, because it meant that that was my contribution. I was able to find a gap and then fill it, and then go back to the same people and say, you know, you inspired me. You know, it's my work, but it's my work which wouldn't exist if it wasn't for what you did. And that matters a lot. And I think, you know, there are all sorts of markers. And yeah, of course, publications is one of them. But actually, when a student who can actually say, you know, I invested 3 years of my life, or my parents invested 3 years, you know, in financially, and I chose to go to this place, and some because they say it's because of you or the department, and you know, went to an open date, all the rest of it. That stays with you. That kind of testimony, I don't think there's anything that can replace it, because it's not that somebody has to say it. They don't have to buy it. It's not, you know, it's actually something that they actually gave up a number of years of their life to do something that, which they could have done somewhere else, but they chose to do it with you. So actually, in that sense, I wonder, because I've been in this job for 17 years and been in the profession, I suppose, well, ever since I went to university, kind of never left. But it's interesting that it's those sort of markers. You know, not every student says thank you, and I'm perfectly fine with that. But it's the few who do that just make you think, actually, that kind of gives me the incentive to carry on for another, I'm not sure, 17 years. I'm not sure how many more years I've done. You know, I'll do it for as long as I can. But you must find that really special, perhaps the best kind of thanks that you could ever hope to get from anyone.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I worked in universities before this, before Kent. And I've kind of been skirting around the edges of academia for ages. I mean, I did a whole project with Mary Beard on Pompeii and music in Greece and Rome 10 years ago, in the British Museum. So I've kind of been flitting around the edges of this for ages. But I mean, I worked with refugees for a while as well, and vulnerable adults and things like that. And it's quite personally taxing, but honest to God, it's one of the best things that you can do, because if you can inspire a love, a passion for your passion in someone else, then that's like, you, that will stay with that person for the rest of their life. Your song may not stay with them for the rest of your life, but the fact that you've managed to inspire them will stay with them for the rest of your life, and probably stay with you for the rest of your life as well. You know, that is what connection and storytelling is all about. You know, that oral tradition of passing on the story is passing on the knowledge and the expertise.
Yeah, I always had a problem with that term impact, because we always...
Oh, don't. My supervisors constantly pull me up on that one.
Yeah, well, I know that you've got to worry about it, because you imbibing it. But that's the interesting bit, though, because... and it kind of is what started this project, this podcast off, because I was interested not so much in, you know, the impact of your work, but why do you get up at whatever time you get up in the morning and do what you do? And I was going to conferences, and someone could talk about their research. It can be amazing, meticulously presented work. But I'm thinking, sure, but why are you doing that? Why, you know, all the other things you could be doing in your life, you've chosen this path. And if I know what that hook is, then I'll buy into it and I'm interested. But without that, it's just some fancy philosopher, theologian, sociologist, you know, which I may or may not ever read, but I can't digest that in the 20 minutes of your paper. Give me a way in. And I guess, and that's no different from anything with radio. Why do I like some presenters more than others? Why do I like some music more than others? It's time and place and accessibility and indeed impact. And I sort of felt in a way that this word, which used to terrify me a little bit, is now one I've kind of harnessed, but using it very much in my own kind of way that may not be meant in the formal kind of AHRC kind of rubric.
I love that.
All right. As we start to wrap up, Anna, I've got just a few follow-up questions that I ask everybody, and it's about things like, well, memories being mainly positive. How would you look back, as you look back at your life and career, what kind of, if you had to sort of give an overview of the way things have gone in your life, would you say that generally your memories are predominantly positive ones?
I'd say, yeah, about 60% of them. I mean, I've had some amazing times, don't get me wrong, and even from childhood before music, I've got some amazing times, but I've been to Austin, I've sat on the soundboard of Paul McCartney's gig, Mary Beard was my interim act. You know, there are some pretty cool things. Oh, I got to play as a Roman goddess in the British Museum. That was pretty cool. Got to walk around dressed as a Roman goddess. You know, it's those little things that keep you going. But, you know, there is a darker side to my industry as well, and I campaign on that. You know, women in music, all sorts of issues. I won't go into that now, but... part of my mission is to make sure that that doesn't happen to another female singer-songwriter ever again. And I'll be damned if it does. And that kind of plays into my teaching as well. You know, you've got a kind of duty to educate the next generation to say that's not acceptable, to get the change. So, yeah, I'd say I don't have any regrets. I guess that's the most important thing, really.
Yeah, because nostalgia is an interesting thing because, and I'm, you know, obviously this is exactly what the project is on, but I guess nostalgia by its definition is about, it's not just thinking, hey, the past was amazing. It's that sense of dislocation. And maybe it's, nostalgia has more to do with the present than the past, but it's about the fact that where we are now seems to be out of alignment with maybe some original form or some existence that we may have had, whether in reality or in our minds, which just felt better, and we want, and maybe worth trying to get that back. So it's as much about the future as well, in that sense of trying to create in the future something that pays homage in some way to what seemed right all those years before. But can you be nostalgic, do you think, about negative experiences?
I think you learn from negative experiences. So yeah, I think it depends on what that's a really trick question, because it depends on what the negative experience was. You know, if you're talking about, you know, a relationship that was not good, you're still going to have nostalgic elements about that. You know, it's down to human psychology as to our way we remember things, and we attach ourselves to certain things. You may miss someone even though they were bad for you. So I don't know. I mean, nostalgia, you have to be really careful with. When you're a creative person, you have to be very careful with nostalgia, because it's very easy to go to the default of it was better 10 years ago. It wasn't. If you actually think about it, it wasn't. And I work as a creative practitioner, I work very hard to keep myself in the present as much as I possibly can, especially during lockdown. That's one of the things lockdown's taught me even more, is reinforce the present, because things are short. You know, especially in the music industry, your time is short in the music industry. I've been here ages. I'm an old timer, you know. But I think keeping yourself in the present allows you to remain fresh and to keep yourself a little bit more balanced. I know lots of people that are very nostalgic, and they are the people that go down the drug route and the drink route. And I don't always think nostalgia is very good for you. It's important to remember, but living in the past is not good for you.
Yeah, because I've always kept the diary, and I'm so glad I have, because the diary is a good corrective against that whole, yeah. It was amazing in those days, because you can look back and you can say, well, what about those stresses that you were having? You know, it's easy to look back at some achievement, whether it's a degree result or a relationship or whatever it might be. And you can say, you know, and you can look back with having achieved that, and everything that came before it is then somehow compensated for. But in reality, the period up until that great achievement was trial an error, and the feeling of inadequacy or imposter syndrome, whatever it is. And I think that is a really important corrective to anything that we do. Otherwise, we're distorting the past. We're not doing it justice. We're kind of almost imagining that something was an easy ride. And something that's an easy ride, actually, like what we're saying about, you know, buying music. If you have to make a pilgrimage to the record shop, well, that's that's a bit of an arduous journey of some sort. You've got to have the pocket money. You've got to actually, you know, yeah, wait till Saturday, or, you know, go on the bus or whatever it is. And that's something which I think I wouldn't want to do without. So nobody wants pain or suffering, but sometimes there needs to be, not everything can be completely amazing. Otherwise, it's all out of proportion. And sometimes I think we need a bit of the two in order to give us some sense of character building.
I also, it's really interesting you say that, because I think art is very useful at reflecting a reality. And I use an example. My husband and I have both watched It's the Sin recently. And, you know, we were both born in the, you know, just in the 80s. And we were both saying, because we were, you know, he would have been a year above me at school, our recollection of the AIDS pandemic, you know, HIV, was very different to the one presented on TV. And there are lots of things from the 80s and 90s where you go, it was very unequal. It was very, you know, there was lots of prejudice. And as a child, you remember your childhood. And I remember the advert that was shown in It's a Sin, but you don't, and you remember some of the things people used to say to each other, but you watch that on TV and you go, that is unacceptable. Why did I not know at the time that this was happening and that was unacceptable? Why do I not look back on that and realise that that was unacceptable? Love is love. End of story. To way they were treated, the way that it was advertised, you know, the actions of the characters. I mean, it's art, it's portrayal. You know, you could question it's subjective, but you look at that and you go, well, okay, I need to look back on the 80s and 90s and actually reassess that. You know, if you watch TV like The Big Breakfast, you go, actually, some of that wasn't appropriate, you know, and now, you know, they're removing a lot of books and TV series from that time because it's not appropriate. And there's obviously there's lots of different academic discussions around that. But we were quite shocked that we didn't realise, and it sounds really stupid as nearly 40-year-old adults, we didn't realise how bad it was. And that's where art plays a really important part. It's a mirror to society. It's a mirror to nostalgia. And it's a really important one to keep that, you know, romance of nostalgia in check.
And just a couple more questions. I mean, when you were younger, could you have imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now? Have you, you know, the whole question about whether you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young, what would your younger self think about what you've ended up doing?
My younger self wanted to make it. My younger self wanted to be signed to a label, playing the big shows. My older self accepts that I would never have been able to cope with that mentally, physically, spiritually, whatever context you want to say. So my younger self would probably be a little bit frustrated. My younger self may be a little bit disappointed, but my older self sits there and goes, well, this is the correct path for me. And there have been things, circumstances outside of my control that have severely impacted my career. I could hold on to those and I could be quite bitter about those, but there is no point because I'm still here. I'm still doing music. I have many peers who are not doing music, who are doing different things and have regrets there. So I guess it's just a balance of you know, weighing up. Me at 21 would not have envisaged me at 39. My brain just wouldn't go that far. But they're the only two things, you know, you chase a dream for so long, it becomes all encompassing. And there comes a point when you have to go, it's not really a dream because it's not a reality. And it may be a reality for a very small percentage, but that's not the correct reality for me. And that takes experience and age, I think, to realise that.
Yeah, I think you're right. The idea of someone, you know, me 20 or 30 years ago could not have imagined I'd be doing what I'm doing now. But of course, that also is life experience. But also it's the fact that maybe the same things that, like a superficial example, doing a podcast, you know, you couldn't do that 20 or 30 years. So the only dream was either you're on Radio 1, you're either doing the charts on a Sunday, or, you know, that was it. The number of kind of opportunities in were very narrow because we had a different kind of, it was in some ways, and not necessarily in a bad way, it was kind of a more analog age.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite shocking when you look at TV films and they've got The Matrix. Oh my God, the phone!
I saw The Matrix at the cinema about a year ago. And I saw it when it came out. Actually, it came out, I think it was the week before my PhD Viva. So, of course, I associate that with a period that doesn't seem that long ago. It was, what, 99. But it looks, and all the, like, they're using hard copy discs. And even the phone, But it's and it's at the time it seemed really futuristic. It's dated really badly compared to a lot of other films that didn't, of course, try to go down the hole. Hey, you know, we're ahead of the game technologically in the 90s.
Everyone wanted that phone as well, didn't they? The flip phone. I mean, even 10 years ago, you know, you look at things. What was it? I May Destroy You. And they did things from like 2006 or 2007. And you're looking at the phones that these kids have got in schools and you go, did we have those 10 years ago? No, really? Really?
My very last question, Anna, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'd say I'm that goal orientated that I'm more of a looking forward person. But being a writer and having to search your own experiences to writing things means that you always have to have a foot in your past to draw on experiences. So I'd say I'm a probably 50-50 girl, to be honest.
Good answer. All right. Well, Anna, do you know, it has been amazing to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
You're very welcome.